Leaders are readers. After interviewing over 300 experts on my podcast, I've compiled the top 30 books written by Mindset Advantage guests. You can download the list and listen to the episodes where I interview the authors at djhillier.com/30books. You can also head over to my Instagram bio to download the free ebook right now. Enjoy.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Mindset Advantage podcast, a show dedicated to insightful conversations in a world full of sound bites. Hosted by fitness coach, performance optimization coach, and national speaker, DJ Hillier. These podcasts are designed to help you attack the gap from where you are now to where you want to be. The episodes take a deep dive into leadership, mindset, and fitness. Follow the show on Instagram at Mindset Advantage Podcast and subscribe to his newsletter at djhillier.com. So let's get to it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. This is DJ Hillier, and you are listening to episode 314 of the Mindset Advantage Podcast. And I am so excited to share with you guys this episode for today. My conversation today is with Dr. John Deloney. Dr. John is a best-selling author, mental health expert, and host of the Dr. John Deloney Show. John has two PhDs and over two decades of experience in counseling, crisis response, and higher education. He is the author of the best-selling books Own Your Past, Change Your Future, and Redefining Anxiety. John has also appeared on Fox News, Fox Business, and Today, and has been featured in The Real Simple and Fast Company magazines, as well as The Huffington Post. John's goal is to help people navigate tough decisions, improve their relationships, and believe they're worth being well. Dr. John is somebody that I've followed for a long time on Instagram, and if you're not following him and you're on Instagram, I highly recommend checking out his page. It's a breath of fresh air, and I just love the stuff that he puts out. He recently came up with a brand new book called Building a Non-Anxious Life. He was kind enough to send me a copy, and my goodness, you guys, this book is incredible. He does such a good job at being vulnerable and at the same time teaching you about anxiety and how to work through it. And anxiety is such a buzzword right now, and it's more popular than it's ever been. And this book, I'm telling you guys, is definitely worth your time. And if you have Spotify Premium, actually, you can go listen to it right now. So if you're an Audible, you like to listen to books on your car ride, I highly recommend checking this book out. Some of the topics we get into were, first, I wanted to know, what is anxiety and what isn't it? I wanted to get really clear on some of the questions so we could set the table before we dove in deeper. After that, we talked about the comparison of anxiety in 2023 versus 2003. After that, we talked about social anxiety, the fastest way to reduce anxiety in real time. We talked about how to gain confidence. And then the meat of the conversation was going through Dr. John's six choices to live a non-anxious life, which is really what his book is all about. So we spent a lot of time diving into what those six are. And at the very end, John gave some very amazing advice to specifically men out there that are struggling with anxiety. And then the last question was advice for parents. What is the advice for parents out there who just want to be great parents, want to be involved, and want to avoid anxiety and live a non-anxious parenting life? I highly recommend staying through the episode because at the end, he just drops some great knowledge for men and for parents. If you are a fan of watching the show, be sure to check out YouTube where we are uploading and catching up on our podcast. You can head to The Mindset Advantage or type in DJ Hillier on YouTube, and that will bring you to our channel. If you enjoyed the show, please be sure to leave a rating, review, give me some feedback. I'd love to hear from you guys. That type of feedback really makes my day and helps to bring on more amazing guests like Dr. John Deloney. This was an absolute pleasure and an honor to have him on the show. I know you guys are going to enjoy this one. Grab a pen, grab a paper, and highly, highly recommend grabbing the book. All right, without further ado, let's get to the conversation with Dr. John Deloney. Let's go. The Mindset Advantage Podcast is brought to you by Element. Element is a tasty electrolyte drink mix with everything you need and nothing you don't. That means lots of salt with no sugar. Element is formulated to help anyone with their electrolyte needs and is perfectly suited for folks following a keto, low carb, or paleo diet. Element contains a science-backed electrolyte ratio of 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, and 60 milligrams of magnesium, with none of the junk. No sugar, no coloring, no artificial ingredients, no gluten, no fillers, no BS. Healthy hydration isn't just about drinking water. It's about water plus electrolytes. And it makes sense. You lose both water and sodium when you sweat, so both need to be replaced to prevent things like muscle cramps, headaches, and energy dips. Rob Wolf, founder of Element, is also a biochemist, New York Times bestseller, and previous guest on this podcast, and is someone I trust dearly. Element is currently being used by the highest performers all over the world, including athletes in the NFL, NBA, NHL, Special Forces, and the Olympics. There are several flavors to choose from. My favorite is the citrus salt, which is how I start every single day. And as listeners of the Mindset Advantage podcast, you can receive a free sample pack by using the link www.drinkelement.com/mindsetadvantage. Again, that's www.drinkelement.com/mindsetadvantage. Go get yours now. One day, while I was co-hosting The Ramsey Show, a caller wanted to know how to get rid of his anxiety. He was scared and had a lot of things going on in his life, and he kept talking about himself like a broken machine that needed to be fixed. After listening to him for a while, I finally told him, "Sir, with all due respect, anxiety is not the issue here." During the commercial break, I took my headphones off and turned to Dave Ramsey, the co-host, and said, "Everybody keeps asking about anxiety. Anxiety isn't the problem. Anxiety is just the alarm system letting people know things are off the rails. People have created very anxious lives, and their bodies are trying to get their attention." For years, I've been telling this to anyone who would listen, students, counseling, clients, colleagues, and even myself. Anxiety is just a smoke alarm letting you know that something in your house is on fire. The alarm is not the problem, the fire is. Dave replied, "You need to write that down. That's your first book right there." And so it was. Dr. John Deloney, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the Mindset Advantage. It's a joy to have you here today. That's a little excerpt from your brand new book, Building a Non-Anxious Life. Welcome.
Dude, thanks, DJ. It's good to be here, man.
Awesome, man. We have so much to get into today with this amazing book. Tell me a little bit about why this book, why right now? Anxiety is such a word that's getting tossed around like crazy now more than ever. Tell me a little bit about why this book, why right now?
Man, I wish I could come up with some altruistic reason. Honestly, I wrote my last book and it did really well, and I thought I had some cachet, and so I wanted to write a book about friendship or marriage. And my publishing team sat down and they're like, "Hey, you're gonna write a book about anxiety." And I was like, I'm kind of done with that. And they said, "That's cute, but this is what you're gonna write." And so when I sat down to write it, it was just like the excerpt you just read. I've been saying this stuff for two decades with families and students and my own clinical work. And then about halfway through it, I realized, oh, dude, you don't want to write this book because you're not living this life. You're running a smoke and mirrors game, and you're burning the people that you love to the ground, and that includes you. And so really, I checked out of my house, went to a hotel. I didn't check out of my house. My wife doesn't run a library card system, but I left my house and I checked into a hotel for a while and really started back at square one. And the book went from me lecturing America on a nerdy treatise on anxiety and what it is and what it's not to me pulling up a stool at the bar saying, "Hey, man, pass the nachos. I'm with you guys. Let's figure this thing out."
A total gut check, man. I can imagine how that would feel. I want to first start with, can we ask the question that's super just plain Jane here? What is anxiety? I think it's a word, like I said, it gets tossed around a lot. Before we get into the nuts and bolts, John, I think we first have to ask, what is it? How do you define it? What does that look like? Can you set the table?
Yeah, that's a great question. Set the table. I like how you said that. So I'm going to set the table here. For years, I was super nerdy, and I like to defend the word. Anxiety, like in and of itself, is a clinical diagnosis. It's a term that clinicians use to label a client or a patient. And then the last few years, I've just realized it's part of our cultural vernacular, right? So it can mean burnout. It can mean just this frenetic chronic stress that we all know people who live with. Or it can be a clinical disorder. It's everything in between. So the way I describe anxiety is simply when your body detects something in your environment and it feels the need to get your attention and let you know that you're not safe. That's anxiety. Mm. And again, what I like about that is it's kind of all encompassing. My alarm system, as a 6'2", 195 pound guy, is going to be different than my wife, than my 7-year-old daughter, right? Our alarm systems are going to be different. And so I can't say that can't make you anxious. I don't get a vote in that. It's their body trying to get their attention about a particular situation or an environment. And so it really frees everybody from the shackles and says, let's go ask ourselves, what's our body trying to protect us from?
What do most people get wrong about anxiety?
They think they're broken. They think it's forever. They think it's a thing they have, like the flu, like it came out of nowhere and it descended upon them, or that it's a genetic disorder that they're somehow like they're a lemon, right? They're like I was going to name a car, but I won't do that. They're somehow less than, they're inferior. And they're always going to be this way. And then they live into that label. They live into that diagnostic and it becomes the lens with which they view the world. I can't take this job because, you know, I've got anxiety. I can't go to this party because, you know, I've got social anxiety disorder. I got back from two tours overseas and I've got this particular form of anxiety. And so I can't fill in the blank. I can't fill in the blank. I can't fill in the blank. And I just am so disgusted by this culture of disempowerment that where we label people, man, and tell them, hey, you just sit in the corner, this is kind of the way things are going to be for you, we'll come heal you, we'll take care of you. And I just think that is so counter to how our bodies are designed to work.
Dr. John, do you think there's more anxiety in the world in 2023 versus 2003, or is it just being talked about more? Tell me the difference between now and maybe 20 years ago. Do you think we're just labeling it easily and that's just being thrown around more than it was 20 years ago? What are your thoughts comparatively in the last two decades that you've been working in this field?
No, I think it is dramatically different. I think it's dramatically different for a couple of reasons, but I think there's been some things that have accelerated the past 10 to 15 years that are just new on the scene. We've created the loneliest generation in human history that's ever lived before. And at the same time, we outsourced everything onto these phones. And I just don't think, I mean, the data's in. It's clear as a bell. And any discussion we want to have after this is us making up a story to best fit what we want in life. But the data's clear. The world fell off a cliff psychologically when we started handing these phones out and when social media popped up. And I think it's easy to point to, we don't know about the mechanics of how it all works. And what about this? And is it this? I don't care anymore. I noticed that my students disappeared in themselves vastly different from 2004 to 2014 and 2014 on. It was a radically different human and an approach to life. And you throw that on top of parents who grew up in the Walter Cronkite world. When that guy spoke, we trusted that guy. And now news, that's not the job of news. News is to get clicks. That's the job. It's a publicly traded entity that its job is to make money. It's not designed to give you information that is factually correct. And so I think all these things happening at once, and the last one is kind of a bridge, is our bodies aren't designed to respond to every single solitary moment of injustice and crime and evil and hurt and pain in the planet. We can't absorb that. We can't carry it. And yet these phones give us access to every hurting person on planet Earth at the same time. And the system overloads. We just can't handle it. And so either you feel callous, just turning your phone off, I just can't know anymore. Or you just bathe in it, man. And our body's got nowhere to go. That's, I think, the core premise of the book is we've created a world our bodies can't live in. And what the hell are we supposed to do now, right? Because it's running and gunning, man.
So I'm here today, Dr. John, and I want to learn. I'm curious about this topic, and the byline of the show is to stay curious. It's on the back of all my
gear. Love it. I love it.
By the way, and I love that part of your book about curiosity. And a part of me too, if I can just be vulnerable and authentic here with you and my listeners, is that I have a hard time understanding anxiety. Because sometimes I think there's very simple fixes, and I personally don't feel a lot of anxiety in my own life, but I'm trying to be empathetic. I'm trying to be here today to learn from you and to learn how I can help, wife, athletes, people that I surround myself with. So I'm here to learn. But one of my questions that I have as I just begin to learn this journey of anxiety, if you will, is sometimes it seems like the word anxiety is turned into a little bit of a scapegoat for people where I can't do that because I have anxiety, and it's just this easy out. And with all due respect, I'm not here to put anybody down. I hope you know that. I hope you see that. But it just seems like because it can be so severe for some people, teachers, athletes, coaches out there are going, okay, he or she has anxiety. We're going to let them fine. Okay. Do whatever you need to do. Talk to me a little bit about, is there some truth to that? Are people using it as a scapegoat? How should we respond when kids, athletes, students come to the table saying, hey, I have anxiety? What are your thoughts there, man? Help me bridge the gap.
I mean, that's honestly the reason I wrote the book is if it's, let's say it is real. Great, man. We have to ask ourselves this one scary question. What do we do now? Right. And let's go back to those six steps in this book and say, let's look at these six areas of my life and see where we're either cleared up or we got some work to do. So that's step one. Step two is, as someone who's both walked alongside countless people and experienced it myself, I was buried by it. It's very, very real. It just doesn't look like what I thought it looked like. Here's an example. After a while, I just started waking up at 2:42 every morning, always. And I thought I had a sleeping issue to solve. I thought I had a bedding issue to solve. I needed a new pillow, a new mattress, a new this. It never occurred to me that my body had recognized that I was living an unsustainable life and that by sleeping, it was failing in its job to keep me safe. And so I think if I'm a coach, I've been a coach before, when a student athlete comes and says, hey, I am so anxious, I cannot fill in the blank. My instant response is always, your anxiety is a context, not an excuse. It is your body trying to get your attention. Let's figure out what, and it might be you need some rest. It might be you need to take three games off, and we hate to lose you, but you have to get your relationships right, your grades right, your sleep right. You've been hurt for a long time, and you've been trying to play through it, and we're proud of you. You're going to cost yourself the whole season or hurt your team more. You need 3 days off. Let's go. It's a context, not an excuse. It might mean you got to clean up your diet and you got to start going to bed. No more Fortnite for the next 4 weeks. Let's see what happens. What's the relationship with you and your girlfriend, you and your parents? So I would start asking some of those deeper questions. I never want to tell somebody, yep, well, sucks to be you. Looks like we're done here. Because I don't think that's the case. And by the way, I wrote about this in my last book. I ended up in a doctor's office, happened to be a close friend of mine. And I explained what was going on. And I walked out of that room with some medication. And dude, I sat at my kitchen table and I wept. My wife was asleep in one room and I had a 2-year-old little boy in the other room. And I wept. I was a grown man. I was associate dean of a university. I wept because I thought I'd failed. And I didn't. I didn't fail. I had just ignored my alarm systems for so long that they became, the calibration on those things were so screwed up. They were setting off at everything all the time. And so I needed as I'd call an electrician if my smoke alarms screw up at my house. I had to go talk to somebody. And he said, let's get these things calibrated. And what it did, medication didn't cure me. It didn't solve me. But it turned the alarms down enough where I could go see a counselor, where I could get back in the gym, where I could sit with a couple of other men and say, I'm not all right. And I wish we knew the mechanics of why talking to other people about what we're struggling with is healing in and of itself. I don't know. I just know it's true, both neurophysiologically and spiritually and anthropologically, like for all human history, been doing this. So if somebody has the courage to come sit down and say, hey, coach, I'm struggling with anxiety. I can't fill in the blank. I would answer with, I'm really proud of you for coming to tell me. I want you to know, I think you can. But I'm going to walk with you as we figure out why your body's trying to get your attention. And that starts to unlabel somebody from, I have this thing to, oh, cool, my gas light's on in my car. Let's figure out how we can get some gas in there. That's a totally different proposition.
Totally. And I think what we're kind of getting into, dovetailing into, is the power of language. And so talk to me about the difference between I'm feeling anxious, Dr. John, and I have anxiety. I mean, there's a difference there. I'm feeling anxious before a game. I'm feeling nervous. Some of those words versus I have anxiety. There's a big difference between those two and how they hit. One is a label. I am this. It sticks with you. It's an identity. One is right. A feeling. It kind of comes and goes. So talk to me about the difference there. And I'm thinking of the athletes before a game. You're feeling anxious. Yeah, we probably all are, right? That's okay.
You should be. You're about to go in front of a whole bunch of people and put yourself out there on behalf of your team. Your body would be failing you if it wasn't like getting ready to party, right? I don't think that's anxiety. I think that's stress. And I think stress is really good. Our bodies need it, right? It's when that stress becomes pervasive. It becomes all the time. And you get off the court and you immediately pick up your phone and you read all of the comments by all the people that watch the game. And then you respond to them all. And then your girlfriend says, hey, by the way, I'm with somebody else right now. And then you're watching your coach and your coach is all upset and broke a clipboard. And then your mom didn't. You can't live like that, right? And then you got your exams the next morning and on and on and on and on. And you're fueled exclusively on Taco Bell, right? You can't do that to your poor body and then get mad at it when it sounds the alarm systems. And so if somebody says, I always double back to the great William Glasser. He was a psychiatrist, and I love the way he would demand accountability from his patients. He never allowed his patients to say the words, I am depressed. I have migraines. I have a backache. They were not allowed to say that. What they had to say is, I'm headaching today. I'm depressing today. I'm anxietying today. And what that did was it let them know their bodies were making a choice on their behalf to try to keep them safe. Let's figure out what's going on there. If I'm a coach, the way I decide, I will decide if we got a problem or not. If you're heading into a very stressful event, I'm going to let that kind of language go. I'm anxious, coach. I'm nervous, coach. Like, I'm going to high five you. I'm going to give you a hug. I'm going to say, like, I am too, man. It is when that becomes a way of life. Coach, I can't go into practice today. Coach, I can't breathe. And coach, I'm not sleeping at night. That we got to get you in somebody ASAP.
Again, during this conversation, I want to be very empathetic towards the people that are going through some of the stuff. So I say this with a little bit of a caveat, but sometimes I try to simplify it, Dr. John, when I'm working with athletes. And if they're feeling or have anxiety, I see that usually as you're thinking about the future. If they are depressed or angry, usually it's something that they're dwelling on in the past. And as a mental performance coach, what I really try to do is get my kids to play in the present moment. We're our best selves when we're in the present. Is that something that you would agree to, that anxiety usually lives in the future, depression usually lives in the past, we got to be right here, right now? Is there anything you would add on that? Is that too simple? Is that accurate? What are your thoughts?
I think I'm always looking for ways I can distill these complex things down. I think for an athlete heading into an event, yes, that's a good way to simplify things. Where it becomes problematic is for most people who are struggling with what I would call diagnosable anxiety disorders, is their body has taken over. Essentially, I'll use me for an example just because it's simple. I had a great job. I finally, after several years of my wife and I trying to have kids, we weren't able to. And then my son comes along. He's healthy. My wife has a great job. I'm working 24/7, 365. Part of my job as a dean of students was to go be in hospitals, do death notifications, sit with sexual assault victims. And I was running a multi-million dollar operation here with the housing and with the intramurals and on and on and on. Right. And so I had all the right thoughts. My body just said, hey, I quit. I'm out. Mm-hmm. And so there is a thinking component to it, but only if the thoughts are also, hey, what of this situation can I control and not control? Hey, how many stories am I spinning up about why the president just did this and why this person did this? How much of the future has my body experienced in the past? Hey, remember that time you got fired? We think that's about to happen again. Remember the time your dad got fired and he was explaining what his boss did? Your coach is doing that right now. Dude, your body's off to the races without your thinking, right? So I am a little wary to blame a body trying to take care of a kid on just not having the right thoughts. And so I do think that the path forward is let's think about this. Let's write it down. And then we're always going to have to act differently. We're going to have to go do different things. That might be talking to somebody. That might be medication. That might be you got to go to the gym. You got to go to bed. You got to sleep, dude. College athletes are the worst. I got to get some sleep. Well, actually, high school kids now, too. They got to go to bed, right? And so that'd be my response. But I think you're right. In general, let's sit down with the kid and try to get our heads right. What of this can we control and what can we not control? I think for a 17 to 25-year-old, it can feel like the world is spun out from under us real quick.
I have a couple more table-setting questions before we get into the six. Another word that pops around a lot and that I'm hearing a lot is the word social anxiety. That's a really common one now, and at least in my circle or what I've been hearing. Dr. John, talk to me about social anxiety. How's it different from just anxiety by itself? And what are you hearing or learning about the word social anxiety?
I mean, it's as simple as your body has identified a group of people as not safe. Ta-da! It's just an alarm system, right? So if someone says, I have social anxiety, great. Are those people unsafe? No. All right, cool. So now we're going to practice. Because I know this. I know that when your body identifies that you're lonely, it'll kill you. It will kill you. And so we have to figure out why. Same as if you have a super sensitive smoke detector in your kitchen and every time you put food on the stove, it goes off. You can't just stop eating. You got to eat or it'll kill you. So we got to deal with this. We got to deal with this smoke detector because it's not calibrating right. That's all it is. And that could be because your mom and dad judged you real bad. It could be that dad took off and your body put a GPS pin. Do not get close to people because they'll leave you. And so every time you head into a social situation, your body sounds the alarms, man. And it could be or you guys got dumped or fill in the blank. You screwed up and hurt a bunch of people and now you're heading back into other circles. It doesn't really matter other than all social anxiety is your body has identified other people as a threat. And so you can't live without other people. So we're going to have to figure that out. And it's simple as the nerd term is exposure therapy, right? You gently start to practice teaching your body, hey, we weren't okay then. We're okay now. We're all right now. And maybe, dude, I was never like, I didn't like going to, like, I didn't like the lights. I didn't like the sound. I just wanted my thing. But dude, you put me in a punk club at midnight and I can run around all night. And so it's sometimes it's context dependent. And so I think it's just having that conversation. You're not broken. There's nothing wrong with you. Yes, your body's identified other people. You probably got hurt in the past. Let's figure out a way to head forward.
As I continue to read this book and I find parallels between both of our work, one of the other parallels that I had was I try to teach and coach confidence for these kids, self-confidence. And I kind of look at it from two different lenses, if I can speak generically for a moment. One of the lenses is to gain confidence is through a lot of preparation and production. And typically that takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of effort and it's not something that can just come by the snap of the fingers. However, I also teach another component of if you need the confidence, you're in the middle of a game or you just got to let go of a shot. How can I get confidence like in the moment? And I teach that by talking about BFS, your body language, your focus, and your self-talk. Your body language got to be big, tall, and bulletproof. Your focus has got to be on the moment. What can you control? Nothing else. And then your self-talk's got to be positive and productive. So it's a good just cue like, bam, here we are. Before we get into those six that take, to me, in my mind, your six pillars are a little bit more on the preparation side. They take a little bit longer. You got to really soak in it. What is the advice for people who are feeling anxious in the moment? Is there something that you like? It's like a, hey, 1 to 3 minutes, do this before you go on stage or before you're feeling this way. Is there anything along that? I'm not looking for a hack per se. I'm not a hack person that I like. It's just going to fix everything. But talk to me about, is there something in the moment? I'm feeling anxious, Dr. John. What can I do right now?
It's going to sound cheesy, but I think a forced smile changes your physiology. Like a... here's what a forced smile does for me. It's a reminder you have felt this way before and somebody believes in you enough to have put you back on this court. You've felt this way. Here's a great example, dude, from my life. I was, I have a show, I write books. The thing I'm the best at is live events, being on stage. And once I started doing this and the show started doing well and I started speaking a lot. So I walked into this event I was doing. And they had gift bags for all the speakers in the green room. Here's the row of gift bags, dude. Gift bag number one, Coach Saban. Coach Nick Saban, name on a gift bag. The next bag, Jocko Willink. Next bag, Jay Leno. Next bag, John Deloney. And I was like, are you freaking kidding me? Like, just a clown nerd on, like, I didn't deserve to be in the same mall as this dude, as those dudes, much less on that state on in that way. And I sat there and I felt my body ask itself, tell itself, get out of here. You don't deserve to be in this room. And so I dropped my shoulders and I smiled real big. And I said, there's some reason that the promoter of this event asked me to be here. And I always get nervous and I always do well. And it was just this sense of, here we go, right? I think we have screwed up the word confidence in this culture as it's something you manufacture or you call it down from the heavens. I'm only confident on stage because I've done it 5,000 times and I've done it with big groups and tiny groups. That's where confidence comes from. And so in the middle of a game and coach looks at you and says, you're taking the last shot. You're going to be nervous. Of course you are. But you're not nervous that you're going to miss. You're nervous that the game, there's people. And so it's just pulling, it's kind of in the moment, pulling it out. I make this shot. I'll make this shot. Right. And I think there's just a confidence because I've made this shot a million times. If coach looks at me and says, Deloney, we want you to take this shot. I'm going to go, yeah, hey, coach, I never made that shot. I can't make that shot. You know what I mean? And, but I'm stupid enough to go, all right, I'll take it. I'll take it. Right. I'll do my best. And so I think you get confidence by those mindless hours in the gym. When I took this job, I remember thinking, I was pretty arrogant. I'm pretty good at this. And I remember it was 4 o'clock on a Friday. I was rolling out and Dave Ramsey, like the radio icon, right? Was sold out arenas all over. I mean, just the guru was on a tiny stage in our auditorium where we work. And he was practicing notes for a small event he was doing the next day for high school kids. And I was like, what is he doing? And they're like, oh, he's practicing for tomorrow. And my first internal dialogue was, he practices for that? And I thought, I remember thinking, oh, this is what doing this for a living looks like now. Now we're in a new game. And so I don't care how good you are on the playground, bro. Like, if you want to go play with the big kids, you're going to find out the big kids are practicing all the time. And it's not like what you see in social media. It is them. They're there late. They're there early. They're there all the time. And then the confidence, man, takes care of itself. I could do that. I've already run through it a whole bunch in my mind and in reality.
Story gives me a little bit of goosebumps, man. I love it. I want to spend the second half of the show diving into the six. So maybe the first thing before we did, I wanted to ask building a non-anxious life. That there, you use those words specifically. Why those words? And then let's dive into the first one.
Anxiety is not the problem. And the culture has said something is wrong with you. You can't do this. We'll do it for you. And if you back out 30,000 feet, we're a culture that has been at war for, 25 years now? We're a culture that's $30-something trillion in debt. We're a culture, and I could go on and on and on. Here's the deal. Nobody's coming to get you. They're not. And so when I have to step back and say, okay, the people telling me I'm broken are the ones telling me they're going to come heal me. They're not doing a great job. What's my next move? Then I have two little kids. I'm married. I've got a team here that I work with. I've got an organization that I work with. I got a church that I am a member of. I've got a community that I live in. We're going to have to make some bold choices and start being proactive about asking ourselves hard questions. What kind of world have we built ourselves that our bodies all the time are telling us we shouldn't be in? All the time. And we got to heal that. So I'm sick of going to war with my body. My body's not the problem. I'm sick of going to war with like the culture of the man. Do what you're going to do. I'm going to be about healing me. I'm going to be about me and my family building something sustainable, and me and my workplace, my teammates, my community. We're going to go get this thing done. And so we're going to build a non-anxious life so that the alarms don't go off all the time. And by the way, I don't want to live in a house without a smoke detector. That's dumb. I don't want to get rid of anxiety. I just want it to let me know when there's an actual threat, not when I am, I haven't slept in 4 days and I'm 7 Red Bulls in. I'm driving 90 miles while also texting and trying to keep up with the Sirius station. And I'm also trying to answer an email on my other phone and check a tweet. Yeah, of course the alarms are going off because I'm about to not be here anymore, right?
The first one hits you right in the face. choose reality. I want to spend some time on each of these six, if you don't mind. Give us the bird's eye view, and then we'll take a deeper dive in. Choose reality. What do you got?
The suckers call it the attention economy. That's a lie. It's the distraction economy. Don't look at what actually is going on here. Look over here. Here's what you need. Here's what you got to buy. Here's how, what you need to manifest. Here's the whiteboard that you need. Here's the journal you need. Here's the shoes, the pants, the whatever you need. The problem with that is all that stuff is cool. All of it's great. And your body knows that your marriage is falling apart. Your body knows that coach is not going to put you on the court. Your body knows that the president of the university is not going to retain your contract next year. And so you might feel like I'm not sleeping. You might feel a little bit low and running and depressed. You might feel snapping at, you might be snapping at your loved ones or your players or your kids at home. The first step to getting well, to building something different, is choosing reality. What is the state of your finances? If you owe money to a car company on a depreciating asset, if you owe money in the form of a mortgage, if you owe money to Visa and MasterCard, your body would be freaking failing you if it let you sleep all night, period. Because it knows if you do one stupid thing at work and you get fired, they take your house and they take your cars and they take your food. Your body would be failing you if it let you sleep, right? So let's choose reality. What is the state of your marriage? What is the state of the relationship you have with your kids, with your bosses, with your players? What is the state of your health? Let's choose reality. And from that starting line, that's where we're going to head off. Most of us don't. We are like, dude, next year I'm going to work out 7 times a week. Dude, have you even taken inventory of your life? Like you can't, like, and what do? You don't work out 7 days a week, and then you think you're a loser, and then you just bathe in shame, and then you try to take cut corners, and you start taking growth hormone, and then that leads you to this. You just start on this other path. Dude, go to the starting line. Everybody starts on the same starting line. What is true for me right now? Let's go from there.
A line in that chapter that really pops out is our bodies are constantly solving for reality, even if we are not. Can you talk deeper on that?
Yeah, if you're married, you can sit on the couch and you're 4 inches from your wife, and you're on your phone checking your email, and she's on her iPad, you know, checking her work issues. And you can lie to yourself and say, no, dude, our marriage is great. We're right here. Your body knows that you're 4,000 miles away from each other. It knows that she's probably checking some other messages too. And you know that you're probably texting somebody back that she doesn't know about. Your body knows. And it will flood you with adrenaline and cortisol because you're always on. You got secrets between you now, and it's going. And that happens across the board. So your body's going to solve for, hey, if you get fired, they take the car. If you get fired, they take the house. And it's going to whisper that to you 24/7, 365. You're going to wake up at 3 a.m. You're going to fall asleep on the couch at 6 p.m. because you're collapsing, and you're going to be back wide awake at 7:15. You're going to stay up till midnight. You're going to do that all the time. And you're going to tell yourself, it's because of work, or it's because of my workout, or it's not. It's your body trying to keep you alive. And so your body's always solving for reality, whether you are or not.
Another line in this book, you say in this chapter, is choosing reality is the practice of taking a true inventory of your life, your work, your relationships, and your values. When it comes to creating a non-anxious life, there are two sides of facing reality, the dark side and the light side. Can we explore what that means, dark side and the light side?
Yeah, man. I mean, the dark side is sitting across the table from somebody you love and saying, I think our marriage is over and we're going to stop playing. It's sitting across the table from your teenager and you've been saying for the last 2 years, oh, that's just them teens. It's not. They don't want to be around you anymore. Because you're hard to be around. That's the dark side. It's an ugly truth. You owe $152,000 in student loan debt and car debt. And that's before your mortgage. Like, we got to deal with that. You cheated on your wife. That's the dark side. The light side is there's a path, right? The light side is, no, our marriage is pretty good. The light side is, dude, I have had a couple of good years. I don't owe anybody anything. So if I get fired mid-season, that'll suck, but it'll be embarrassing, but we're going to be all right. That is me not driving 17 cars. I got one car. It's great. Cool. That is the light side. So it's not about digging into all the dark stuff. Nah, man, it's just taking an inventory. What is the state of things? Some of the stuff might be really great. Most of it might be great. The things that aren't great, we got to deal with those things.
So to heal from anxiety, we must no longer avoid it or run around it. We must go through it. And I'm just curious, what's the tactical for the people out there that are listening right now? They're going, that sounds great. How do I do it? Where do I start? That's a daunting task for some people to face reality. I can just imagine people listening. How do you start with something so broad like that?
Just simply pay attention to what your body tries to avoid. Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm going to go see coach. I'm not going to see coach. Oh, there it is. Hey, man, check your ATM balance and see. I'm not checking that. Oh, there it is. Hey, call your dad now. I'm not calling my dad. That's it. So your body starts to build the walls to protect you and keep you safe. And let's head into that. Hey, have you checked your grades yet? Dude, I'm not checking that. That's the path forward because your body knows your grades probably aren't that great. We've all gone on the spending spree for Christmas or for holidays or for somebody we're dating. And you kind of have that sense like I'm getting real close to the edge here, but you just want this. I want to get this. I want to get this. Choosing reality is every time you make a purchase, just look at your app, like your every dollar app on your budget or whatever on your phone, and just see where you are. And then deciding, I'm not going to buy those last three gifts because I'm too close to the edge and I gotta keep water on in my house, right? It's just about heading into the storm. And most of the time, your body tells you. On the court, man, that's that guy. Coach says, calls timeout. I was a basketball coach and I'd be hollering at kids to take charges all the time. That's that guy. Like, I don't take a charge when he's got the ball. That's the guy I've got to take a charge from. Right. And you're on the court and you bite down on your mouthpiece and you take a charge. And I think that's you get up from that sore and you get nailed. And all of a sudden you grow 6 inches. And that dude who thinks they're invincible suddenly shrinks 6 inches. Right. And so it's just heading into the storm.
Yeah. I love that. So it sounds to me like having the awareness is probably step one, being aware of the area that you don't want to step in. It might cause you anxiety and then just say, screw it. I'm going to do it. For some people, it's like they get anxiety about cold calling or calling the pizza delivery. It's like, I don't know. It just makes me feel anxious. Just once you notice that you have awareness, go just step in and do it. Yes. Right. Is that what I'm hearing?
It's like, I've got a rule that whenever I'm always watching the fights. I never miss the fights. And when a buddy calls and says, hey, we're all getting together to watch the fights. You coming tonight? And my first thought is, nah, man, I'm just going to go to bed. I 100% of the time make myself go. Like, Deloney, all right, I'll be there. And I've never, not one time have I regretted it. I always am glad I did it. When I was doing MMA a lot, it was always that first kick, you get hit and you're like, dude, that hurts. Well, now I have a choice. Am I going to run out of the gym? Or the other choice is, all right, dude, I'm bringing hell with me, man. And it may not end well for me, but what other choice do I have? Most of us just kind of go into neutral and we get banged up and we don't die. And we tell ourselves this lie. I can't do it. I don't know how to do it. And it's not true. We put the car in neutral and we survived, but man, we never win. We never win. So I say, man, put the sucker in drive. You're already in the ring, dude. Put the car in drive and just go right through it. Whatever that thing happens to be. It could be algebra. It could be your job application. It could be your dealing with your marriage. Whatever the thing is, put it into drive and go right through it. Because healing is on the other side. Whether the outcome is what you wanted or not, that's where you're going to find peace.
What else, if anything, do we need to know about choosing reality before we go to choosing connection?
You often can't do it alone. Mm. I get real emotional about things. And so I don't see things clearly. So I got a group of guys in my life. That's why I have a performance coach. That's why I've got people that are seeing things from a different perspective than me. And for some reason, we think those people are cowards. Like, I'll do it myself. Well, you're an idiot, man. Like, no Navy SEALs go to battle alone. They're not dumb, right? No sports team goes into a game without a coach and 7 coaches up in the box. I mean, that's just foolish. And so why in the world would you do that with your marriage? Why in the world do you do that with your money? That's just stupid. So have people in your corner that you can say, hey, man, my wife just said this and I just got fired up. Am I crazy? I got a couple of buddies that'll be like, yeah, dude, go tell her you're sorry. You're a moron. And because I was wrong. And I got so fired up and emotional about it. And by the way, when you get emotional, your brain unhooks critical thinking. It's gone. It just wants to go to war. or to run. So, dude, yeah, have some people in your life. You can't do that part by yourself.
I love it. And that dovetails right into choose connection. And the quote from that chapter is, like it or not, other people are your emergency fund for life. You could do a whole podcast, probably a whole book on just this concept alone. Can we talk a little bit deeper about why choose connection is number two?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's become part of the cultural vernacular now. Everybody kind of knows the cigarettes thing, that, you know, when your body detects you're lonely, it's worse for you than smoking. And the deal is this: the way we are living right now will end dramatically for all of us if we don't radically change the way we do our lives in isolation. We're never intended to live the lives we have. And by the way, well, you know, we've all heard that quote, 70 to 90% of communication is nonverbal. I actually think it's higher than that. We did not evolve to talk to each other in text emojis. We just didn't. And in black and white text, we evolved in small little tribes where we look at each other's body language and eye crinkles and hand movements and ear movements. And we've just sucked all that out of communication and we text each other all day. That's cool for transmitting information, man, but you are not connecting with somebody and your body will bury you. It will bury you. Alcohol works. Adderall works. Xanax works until it kills you. So you have to have people in your life that you do life with that you can look at and say, hey, dude, this thing awesome happened, and everyone cheers for you. And they're not like, oh yeah, bro. And you have to have people you can tell the dark, dark stuff to, man. You just have to. It's full stop, end of story. You got to.
Page 117, you say, when a prisoner violates the rules of their jail, they are sent to isolation, the hole. After a judge and jury have removed a person's freedom and locked him or her away, there is still one more punishment that can be dished out. They can pull him or her from the presence of other prisoners and make them spend time alone, completely alone. Some psychological researchers consider isolation a form of torture. And now this is all of us. We're doing this to ourselves. Have you ever sat at a table of family and friends surrounded by people who care about you? Maybe at a reunion, a big work event, a baby shower, or a church potluck, and felt like you were absolutely alone? Have you ever grabbed your phone for the 100th time and realized still no one has texted you? Or have 29 text messages all asking you for something, but nobody's checking in on you? Ever fold your laptop for the day after working from home and realize you didn't hear the voice of anyone who wasn't on a podcast? This is the world we've created.
There you go. Yeah. And I had to... My default is loneliness. My default is go do things by yourself. That's when things get dicey, I'll figure it out myself. Y'all just go. And I had to make a change. I'm having to make a change. This is not something that just goes away. It's a daily struggle for me to not isolate myself. And by the way, I realized when I was sitting at a table full of people that loved me, I know they did, but I felt so incredibly alone. I spent time blaming them. I've been in locker rooms where I was like, none of you guys know me. And I think the natural, honest response is, well, it's because you're not sharing yourself with us. Speak up. Tell us about your home life. Tell us what's going on with your family. Tell us what's going on with your grades, with your girlfriend, like, or your boyfriend. Like, you got to join this thing too. And so it was easy for me to point fingers at everybody. Like, man, you don't even know me. Well, cool. It's up to me to make that call. And, it just is what it is. We've just created the loneliest generation ever. I said that earlier. And I've got to put my technology away. I got to call people. I've got to invite people over. And by the way, nobody cares. Nobody cares. I was recently, we filmed the show, and one of the things with a guy who was struggling with anxiety, one of the homework assignments I gave for him and his wife is they had to invite somebody over once a week, and they had to put something in their living room that they were embarrassed to have out. And at one point they, because if not, it was a show, right? They cleaned the house. They got the house cleaned up. They lit candles. They were performing for the people coming over. That's not connection. That's not connection. That's a movie set. And so they had to put, you know, a basket of laundry. They had to leave the trash out. They had to just leave crap laying around the house. Now you're getting into connection. Just come over to my house, dude. Bring whatever food you got in the fridge. I got some here. Let's just hang out. That's a totally different story.
Well, that's cool, man. You said choosing to do life alone is choosing to die early. Choosing to do life alone is choosing to have an anxious life. And choosing to do life alone is a choice to take everyone around you down with you. I think I've heard you talk about this on other podcasts too, Dr. John, is that sometimes it gets more difficult the older that we get. We're in school and there's kids and people everywhere, college. It's like, it's hard not to have friends. You live with five other people. The older we get, the circles get a little bit smaller and everybody's kind of got their crew. Talk to me about what's the advice if you're speaking to people. I'm 31, so maybe not my age, maybe more like if you're speaking to the 40-year-old, the 50-year-old, that's like, I don't have the connection that you're saying I should have. I want it. How do I do it at this age? Because I would imagine the conversation with the 50-year-old is different than you would with the 19-year-old. Can you talk to those people specifically?
Yeah, I think it's this, I think it's the problem is as big as clean drinking water. If suddenly you turn the faucet and there's no drinking water in there, everything in your life would stop until you found water. Whether you went to the store to buy it, whether you went to a local creek and took buckets and whatever you got to do, you'd go find water. I think my 40 and 50 and 60 year old friends, that's where we are. And so it's not a matter of, well, you know, no, it's fresh water. What are you going to go do? I have a crazy job where I'm all over the place all the time. And then big chunks of my day, my phone is off because I'm recording. And so I can't just come and go and willy nilly. So I have to be hyper intentional about it. And feel free to edit this part out. I don't know the demographic of your listeners. It's when I talk to married couples who've been married for 2 or 3 years, and then one of them goes to grad school or both of them get promoted or they have a kid. You got to put sex on the calendar. And it's always like, you know, like it's just kind of not, you know, romantic. Cool, dude. You're either going to put it on the calendar and you're going to plan for it. And by the way, it becomes way more erotic when you think about it all day, or you're not going to do it. So what do you choose, right? You want this imaginary bullcrap Hollywood that's not real, or do you want to actually have lots of sex? Put on a calendar, right? And so similarly, I've got to be intentional about having friends. So I've got a group of guys that live sort of close to me. I live out in the woods here in Nashville. All right, cool. Then we're going to go eat pizza. You know what I don't eat, dude? Pizza. I just don't. It's just not good for me. I don't sleep. But if that's the restaurant where we all live out in the woods, then that's where we're going to go, man. I'm going to figure something out because connection is more important than my little like nerd diet or whatever I'm doing, right? And 40 and 50 and 60 year olds have to make it a priority. And by the way, the greatest thing you can give your kids is not attending 100% of everything they ever do ever. In fact, I would suggest that they can't handle it when you do, because it makes them the center of your universe and they can't hold you up. They're not strong enough to do that. So have a Monday night thing where you and the guys go every Monday night and y'all go hang out. You and the girls go hang out every Wednesday evening. And if it happens to be a baseball game night, cool. I'll see you when you get home, honey. I can't wait to hear about the game. I can't wait. The greatest gift you can give your kids is a regulated nervous system and a warm, laughter-filled home, and not attendance at everything at the cost of all of your money and all the chaos and all of the. And so what do you have to do in your life to have a peaceful, warm, laughter-filled home? Let's try to build that. And that's going to include hanging out with your friends.
And every time you do this, it always feels good, right? You might, but beforehand, it's like, I don't know, I don't want to go, or gosh, it's so much work. I got to drive here. I don't know about you. I feel that sometimes beforehand, but every single time driving home, you're like, God, you know, that was fun. It's good to get
always
guys, tell
always
the same stories, do the same shit, but it just fills your cup again. But we have this running excuse, Dr. John, that I'm too busy for that, or they're too busy for that, and we just don't have time for it. But what you're saying, and with all these choices, they're choices. You get to choose, take right. some ownership. This isn't something that somebody else is going to do for you, like you said in the beginning. That's what I love about all this, is that it's your choice, man. It's your choice if you want to live a non-anxious life. Here are the steps. You have to be intentional about it, just like mental performance, just like getting in shape. You have to be intentional about it. It can't just be this victim mindset. I get fired up here because this is the stuff I teach, is that, hey, this is just who I am and I can't do anything about it. Bullshit. This is what you can do. You have to choose. You have to go. It's going to be inconvenient sometimes. You're going to miss some stuff.
Right? It's always going to be inconvenient. Yeah. It's always going to be inconvenient. Always, always, always. And it's worth it. It's worth it. And I think what some of the early critique I got on the book was, oh, so people just, you're telling people choose anxiety? No, nobody chooses anxiety disorders. But we do make those decisions, like you just mentioned, every day. Dude, am I driving 30 minutes to go hang out with my friends at 9 o'clock at night to watch the fights? I'm going to go to bed. Plus, I've been listening to Huberman and Tia, and they tell me to go to bed, and I need 9 hours of sleep. So, and Dr. Walker says that. Fine. What you're choosing is your body's going to pop you wide awake at 2:30 in the morning for the next 6 months. That's a choice, because your body's job is to keep you safe and keep you alive. And it knows you have no one. You've got no one. And so, cool. Choose sleep. That's fine. Choose to stay home. That's fine, dude. Do that. And in the meantime, you're choosing also for your body to have to get your attention another way. It's the same thing as not saving money, right? Like, I just got paid and I had got a good bonus. Cool. I'm going to choose to go buy these clothes, these shoes, another cell phone case, this and that. Cool. You're also choosing to not sleep because your body's going to let you know things aren't okay. These are all choices, man. It's all choices.
And I'm having a blast in this conversation, man. Talk to me about the choice of freedom. You have the four areas for freedom in the book. This is a great chapter as well, just like the entire book was. Walk me through the freedom.
Well, yeah, and I picked four. It could have been 500 of these freedom choices. But ultimately, the nerd word is agency or autonomy. When your body knows you're not driving the car that is your life, it will sound the alarms. And what, as I dug into the clinical literature on this, I was kind of bummed out because I'd never, not only did I not have a course on this in grad school, I didn't have a 1 hour class on this stuff in grad school. I never learned about the biology and physiology and psychology of debt, of owing people money. You know, the old Bible scripture, like the debt is slave to the lender. Your body knows that Ford Motor Company is telling you what you're going to do tomorrow. Your college president, if you're a college coach, they run your life. If you have a truck payment and a house payment and a whatever payment, because you have to do what they say. You gotta dance when they say dance, because if you don't, you lose everything. And so, or you have that 6 months weird of scrambling, like, hey, bro, you need a strength coach. You need a whatever, like a, I'll do the, man, your body knows. Also, clutter. Our bodies have evolved over gajillions of years for scarcity. And now all of a sudden we are surrounded by so much stuff and our bodies don't have a psychology for it. Doesn't have a wiring system for it. And it just begins to slowly suffocate us. And calendars, we created calendars, man, where if one thing gets off for 5 minutes, the whole week falls over. Our bodies aren't designed for that, man. It was designed to lay around, go get some food, lay around, I'll fight, It's not designed to go all the time. Most people I talk to, when they first start considering I might be struggling with anxiety, they think about their thoughts when they lay down in bed. And their thoughts just start spinning like a kid on one of those merry-go-rounds on a playground. That's the first time you've paused in an entire day. That's the first time you've given your brain a moment where you don't have a podcast in or an audiobook in or a murder podcast in, and you get home and then you turn on music and you got this on and then you're talking and then you have this in the background. That's the first time your brain went, okay, we got to think about some things here. And what do? We go take some meds and shut that voice off, right? And then we get up the next morning, we go again. So calendars, and then the last one is just boundaries, man. How many of us, our mother-in-law is still telling us what we're going to do for Christmas? Our moms or our sisters or our brothers are still telling us this. Hey, we're all buying this for Christmas. I don't have that kind of money. Oh, really? We're all doing that. And so we live these non-agency lives. And so all that chapter is choose freedom is, I'm going to stop solving for what are people going to think is cool. I'm going to stop solving for, I have to do fill in the blank. I'm going to start solving for free. I'm going to start solving for peace. And then I'm going to reverse engineer my life that way. What does that mean? I'm going to be on less committees at work. What does that mean? I might stay at this D2 school because yeah, D1 school would be cool and it pays another 30 grand, but I don't want that life. I want to see my kids. I'm going to stay at a D3 school. Because D1 life, yeah, I see it on ESPN, but D1 life is another life, right? I want to actually go to college and laugh a lot and probably eat too much of the cafeteria. I just want a different world. Great, man. Knock your lights out. But I'm solving for peace. I'm not solving for what all these other people want from me for their life. And man, that's a game changer.
I underline this the line. I love to go a little bit deeper on it before we go to choose health and healing. Is the line was, because no matter what you throw away, however you pay off your debts and however strong your boundaries are, you will always go with you. You talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, man, we just have a culture of that has trained us that once you get to there, wherever there is, then things are going to be okay. Once you finally get that job, then your dad's going to just suddenly call you and be like, hey, I'm proud of you. And by the way, if that call hasn't come yet, that call's not coming. And if it does come, it's because you've been propping his ego up for a long time. It has nothing to do with you, right? It's just this idea, yeah, go to D1 school, man. And if you're pretty anxious and pretty depressed as a senior in high school, that's coming with you. A D1 school is not going to solve that for you. If you don't go to the gym very often, and then all of a sudden you decide to crush it and kill it, and you don't deal with some of the core stuff, man, you're going to have six-pack abs. You're going to be able to bench 300 pounds, and that anxiety is coming for you. It's going to find you, because wherever you go with you. And so the real challenge is, how do I be okay here, right where I'm at? And if you're okay here, bro, you can be okay anywhere. And I tell people all the time, my personal friends, and we talk about it like kind of laughing. If I'd had this job with this level of success 10 years ago, I'd already be long gone. Dude, I'd be a vapor, gone. It wasn't until I unhooked myself from all of it, from my higher ed jobs, from my dean of students jobs, from my faculty jobs, all that. And then I decided, dude, I'm going to be a good dad and a good husband and a great friend. And then when I got this thing, it's awesome. It's cool. Like, it's fun, man. It's not going to last forever. And you just hold it really loosely, which weirdly makes you really good at it. And it just works recursively that way. So wherever you go with you. There is not an external thing that's going to solve it. I promise.
Number four is choose health and healing. And this podcast really started off as a fitness podcast a couple of years ago. So I think this would be the one chapter that I think my listeners really got down. But is there anything that you would suggest on the health and the healing side of things that most people get wrong that you think would just be a good little sliver before we move on to the fifth one?
Yeah, you can't have a good marriage if you don't feel good. You can't be the best coach you can be if your knees hurt and your shoulder hurts and your neck always hurts. You're never going to be able to show up with your kids if you haven't dealt with your own childhood where your dad was an alcoholic. So you're worth going to counseling. You're worth getting in shape and not like snap into a Slim Jim, not that kind of shape. I'm talking about exercising. You got to move your body, dude. We just reached a point where look around us. We're all dying. You got to move your body. You got to exercise. You got to eat as close to good as you can. And you and I were talking to Jay before. I have a holiday bourbon ball. I don't know what this is. It's just a massive chocolate and joy in here. I don't normally eat this, but it's delicious and it's Christmas. And one of my teammates made it for me. So I'm going to eat it and I'm going to love it. And I might have to put in a few more minutes. So what? It's awesome. And so it's not about like, oh, dude, you got to be kissed. No, I'm talking about health and healing. I'm talking about you're never going to be your full best self. Your body's going to always be trying to get your attention if it knows the engine of the car is not okay.
Awesome. Next one is choose mindfulness. Dr. Ellen Langer was just on this podcast. And I know you're familiar with
her. No way, dude. Really?
Yeah, she's awesome, isn't she?
How you got me following Dr. Langer, man? That's that's like you got LeBron on here, then you got some middle school basketball player at a local high school.
I've been extremely fortunate, man. The last 5 years have been crazy. Some of the people I've gotten to talk to.
Ellen Langer, dude.
Yeah, and she's phenomenal. And we talked about mindfulness, and I love the way you took it into my favorite word of all time is curiosity. My listeners are rolling their eyes because they're like, dude, you bring this up every podcast. But I really believe, Dr. John, that curiosity is a superpower. And what you said, I wrote down here, you said that curiosity can either both change your life and save your life. And immediately I was like, me and John are best friends, dude. So I want you to talk to me a little bit about from another person rather than just me just saying curiosity is the way to go. When you say mindfulness and curiosity, why is that so important and why'd you put it in this book?
We're killing ourselves with judgment and we're killing ourselves with snap responses. We have a very reactive culture. They did this, so I'm doing this, right? And I remember one time a president several years ago, this is probably 10 or 15 years ago now, apologized, said the words, I'm sorry. And you would have thought that he got caught shooting heroin on like national television. And I was like, what are we doing here? You can't say sorry. Like, and it was this strange, it was ownership. It was, hey, I thought this was the right thing to do and I was wrong. I now that I've considered, I should have done this. It's just not how our culture is wired, dude. We are wired to, you should know all the answers all the time right now. Go do. And if somebody doesn't, if that dude cuts you off in a car, it's because he's doing drugs and he's an idiot, or coach doesn't play you. It's because coach, man, if you can just for one millisecond, just stop. Say, I wonder why coach isn't playing me. The difference between instantly making up a story about why coach doesn't like you, he didn't like guys like me, he didn't like guys from where I came from. Maybe ask yourself, I wonder why he's not playing. Could it be me? Or when the example I use in the book is, my wife and I had this like really, I actually flipped it in the book, and this is kind of just me poking at my wife. I leave crap everywhere at my house. I got stuff everywhere. It's just a walking disaster. And because I spend most time in my head. My wife tells me I was born in the wrong century. She's like, you're just not walking around thinking about stuff. And I always just set stuff down, always. And so she had like a, like, I love you conversation. Like, hey, and here's what I need in this house. We have two kids. We have dogs everywhere. We got chickens. We got, I don't know, whatever. Can you just pick up your stuff? Pick up your piles. And I was like, yeah, I got it. I'm in. And then the next morning, dude, I overslept. I had one kid that had an exam. I had another kid that was doing something. My wife was gone. And I was just running around like a maniac trying to get it all out. And I left a pile of stuff. I mean, we just had this big come to Jesus, like our marriage is going to be different from this point forward. And I pledge allegiance to all of it one night. Next morning, left crap everywhere. And she did this so well. She walked in the house and after leaving like 4 a.m. for something, saw a pile of stuff. And she said her body tensed up. And then she exhaled and said, we just went through this last night. For him to have left a pile right here, this morning must have been a disaster. I wonder what happened. And she could have said, we just talked about this. He sucks. He doesn't care about me. I can't believe that dude. And what she chose was curiosity. I wonder what happened. She didn't default to an instant response. And by the way, that happens. My default setting is to grab candy all the time, 24/7, 365. For some people, it's cigarettes. For some people, it's dip. For some people, it's pornography. For some people, it's texting somebody. For some people, it's all the time, all the time, all the time. It's right when you're about to grab that thing. If you could just stop and say, ooh, what is my body trying to protect me from? Oh, okay, because I'm stressed. Or, oh man, I'm about to go into a heavy meeting. Or, oh, coach is about to. That's the path towards stopping some of those behaviors that help in the moment, but are destructive long-term. So, man, if you just can train yourself to default to curiosity. Dude, I wonder why that politician keeps saying that. It's because he sucks and because they... Dude, I wonder... Like, I'm just going to live a more curious life. And by the way, my blood pressure goes down when I do that. Just a gentler way to do things, man.
I love it. I always say, get curious, not furious. That's on some of my...
Oh, dude, that's awesome. You should tattoo that on yourself. That's a good one.
Walt Whitman says, be curious, not judgmental. I think what I'm learning here from you as I explore my favorite word is that with curiosity, it sounds like there's a component of pressing pause.
That's it.
There's a component of responding versus reacting.
That's it.
And it's being able to take one little step away for just a moment. I hadn't thought about it like that. What are your thoughts on that?
Back when I was doing mixed martial arts, the greatest thing I could do is to get somebody to be reactive, because then I win. Then you win. If I just get you automated, leg kick, oh, here comes a jab, leg kick, jab, leg kick, jab. Then that's how John Jones knocked out Machida, right? He set him up 4 times and he realized, oh, this is on autopilot. He is just reacting. Every time I throw a kick, he just throws a punch, the same punch. And so John Jones faked a kick and then just sent him into the netherworlds, right? And because he went right for it again. So Jocko calls it detachment. Michael Singer, the great, mindfulness guru, Dr. Langer, it talks about mindfulness. Whatever word you want to use for it, if you can create space between the impulse to respond and your actual response, if you can create space there, you win life. You become the dad you want to be, the coach you want to be, the athlete you want to be, the nutrition person you want to be, the husband you want to be. You change everything if you just pause before you react. It doesn't mean that at sometimes burning it all down is the right move. Sometimes that is. Sometimes taking a swing is the right next move. Just make sure that's the right move, and then we're going in, right? And so it's not about being passive. It's about making sure I'm calibrated about what I'm about to do next.
I could GM on that topic all day with you. Let's go to number six to finish off here. Choose belief. Talk to me about the power of belief.
Yeah, this is not like the new agey, but like, you just got to believe in yourself, bro. This is really more of a spiritual thing. And it's fun for me behind closed doors to begin to speak to, I mean, I've been doing it for years, but to speak with neuroscientists who are finally just kind of dropping their shoulders and saying, dude, there's something bigger than us out here. And I know it sounds woo-woo and new agey or whatever, but never before in human history has civilizations not walked outside and looked up to the sky and said, dear God, or dear gods, please rain, or my family dies, or please stop raining. We're about to be flooded out. And we're all about to end. And then overnight we have little boxes we can push a button on and food shows up at our house, and we push a button and our toilet's flushed and takes our cha-cha away and sends it to some place that we don't even know where it goes. And we all of a sudden get really arrogant about we are the center of the universe. And so choosing belief is about realizing you can't hold up the universe, man. If your body thinks it's holding up the universe, it's going to sound the anxiety alarms. And so me and my family were Christian. I choose God. I don't care what you believe in, but you have to believe in something bigger than yourself, or your body will sound every alarm it's got because it can't carry that weight.
Powerful line in this chapter was, you're worthy of being loved. You're enough. You always will be. And you cannot do it on your own. Powerful.
There you go. I mean, I think that speaks for itself. Yeah. Think of the universe like a squat bar. You just can't hold it all. You can't. And we were never designed to. And all these psychological theories were self-actualization. Like, you should be self-actualized. There's no such thing, man. What we're finding is, you got to take a knee, believe in something bigger than yourself. It's humility. And from that position of humility, we're able to move through the world. And that's a non-anxious life. That's peace.
Awesome. I have two final questions here. I like to close down with advice questions to my guests. And there are two people specifically that I would like you to speak to, because I think you're the perfect person to ask for on advice on these two people. The first person I want you to give advice on, Dr. John, is men. Specifically, I think right now we're in a day and in an age where men are having a hard time being vulnerable, and more men are maybe feeling anxious, but the testosterone, the masculinity, we don't want to talk about it. So I would love to just get a snippet of you of what's the advice to men out there who are feeling their anxiousness. They don't really know what to do. They don't know if this is the right. What's the advice to men specifically who are feeling anxious in 2023?
Your anxiety's right. You've been told that the whole world is falling apart because of you, and that the way you are inherently built and designed and made is the root of all evil. And it's not true. And men can destroy lots of lives with their rage and their anger and their stupidity and their bad ideas. Both are true. And so what do? You work really, really, really hard to develop your character and your strength, your actual human strength, to become somebody who has value in your culture and in your homes and in your workplace. And you also have the courage to understand the rules have changed. My dad, when he married my mom in 1970, she was not allowed by law to sign her name on a mortgage. Women were not allowed to do that. That's my parents. That's not very long ago, right? In 1973, she was allowed to get her own checking account without my dad. And my dad was a homicide detective. He was a SWAT guy. He's a bad dude. And so my parents had to learn in real time. They had to change the tires on the car while it was flying down the highway. How do we have a marriage where my mom makes more money than my dad? My mom went and got a PhD later in life. My mom and dad are both brilliant, and they're both solving these problems. That's a different world. So men also have to understand that the rules have changed. It's no longer someone's just going to say, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. It is, hey, honey, here's what I need. I need to learn how to say those things out loud. What does that mean? That means men need new tools. period. And so it's both and moving forward. It's not, well, then I'm just going to never go in a gym and I'm just going to like try to read more poetry. No, I want guys who can go to the gym and I want guys who can take care of themselves and their communities and their families and who read poetry and who can fix a faucet and who can say their needs out loud and tell other men, hey, dude, I'm not okay. Right. So gotta do the traditional masculine stuff. You gotta go do it. And you gotta realize the rules have changed. And so we as men collectively have to go out and learn new relational tools to interact with ourselves in the world. And we just gotta get over ourselves, man. Cause if we don't, we now have the tools that have never existed before to just wreck the whole thing.
My last question is the advice for dads specifically. We're expecting our very first child in February. And so part of this is a selfish question, but I just think that there needs to be a message specifically to fathers out there. And I know you're a father. You've done a lot of work with families and parents. I want you to speak specifically to the dads out there now. What's the advice? What have you learned over your 20 years in this work? What have you learned from people calling in on your show? Speak directly to the dads. What advice do you have out there that you think every dad needs to hear?
Every dad needs to know that your kids need you to look them in the eye and touch them on the face every single day of their life and to say, I'm so glad God picked me to be your dad, period. Dads need to hug their sons and not side hug, weird side hugs. Grab their sons and put your hand on the back of their head and put their face in your chest and say, I love you. I'm so glad you're my son. And for 99% of us, our dads did not do that. They weren't allowed to do that. They were told they would ruin their sons. Dads need to grab their daughters and ask permission. Can I give you a hug, honey? And they might say, no, dad. And just know they still love you anyway. Dads need to, more than anything, honor and love their mother. The kid's mother, and they need to teach their kids through demonstration. This is what love looks like. This is love expressed. And if you don't know how to be a good husband, go get some people in your life, some professional help, some other men, go get a coach and figure that out. If it makes you super uncomfortable to hug your kids, I get that. I've seen that all over the country. Cool. You got to practice it because your kids need you to show up and show up and show up. And by the way, go work really hard in your job. Tip the waitress really, really well. Say thank you. Teach your kids civility in out in the marketplace. And if you got to, stand up for your family. If you have to, stand up for the least of these in our communities. Continue to model. Here's the last thing I'll say about dads. You can tell your kids whatever you want. They do not listen to you. Your kids watch you. So if you want to raise kids who know how to take care and know how to love and how to be people of character, you take care of people. You be a person of character. You tell the truth. You honor their mother. That's fatherhood.
Dr. John Deloney, ladies and gentlemen, wow, you're an incredibly wise man. This was a bunch of fun. For my listeners out there who want to support you, what's the best way to do that?
You can pick up the book, Building a Non-Anxious Life, anywhere you buy books. And you can follow me on the internet at John Deloney. And you can listen to the Dr. John Deloney show. It's a call-in show where people call in and kind of like old school Dr. Phil. So it's a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. John. You're somebody that I really look up to, man. I really enjoyed the book. I really enjoyed this conversation. I look forward to staying in touch in the future, man. Really, really appreciate it.
Thanks, DJ. Come to Nashville. Let's hang out.